At the Table with Tony is brought to you by Trafe Hustlin'. That's www.traifhustlin.com. Your home for all things barbecue.
Welcome to At the Table with Tony. My name is Anthony Giglia, better known as Tony Mangia. And today I want to welcome you to the show. I have a great guest. I'm excited for the next hour or so to be talking to my friend, Michelle DiPietro. Did I say that right, Michelle?
Got it right. And I thought your last name was Mangia, so I don't know what you were saying earlier.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mangia, that's my split personality. That's
yeah, of course.
That's my social media name. But again, I do want to thank you for taking some time out today to be a guest, for being a guest on At the Table with Tony.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. This is awesome.
Well, again, we kind of know each other over the years through social media, which is where a lot of, you know, people say social media is bad. Yeah. Well, Tony, it's bad if you use it for bad,
right. But
it's great if you use it for good. And we met through a mutual friend of ours, Ray Guarini. The head of the mastermind of Italian enclaves. You guys have to check it out. It's one of the most amazing websites and social media accounts out there. But so that's how we originally met, I guess, in person. That was the first time we met in person, was through.
Yes. Yeah. Although I feel like you and I followed each other prior to the introduction of Ray.
Yes. But
Ray was the one that got us together in person. I think it was that lunch in Little yeah. Italy, right?
That was a great day. A pre-COVID, pre-Christmas yeah. luncheon that was. It was great. We went to Cafe Napoli.
And then afterwards we went to Ferrara.
Yes, we did.
And we had a little Christmas coffee with a little something in it. And I think we all had dessert. It was nice.
No, it was. But again, I want to talk to Michelle. She has a great resume, food related resume, and you know she has a great presence on social media. I know I mentioned we talked a couple of weeks ago about, you know, we were setting this show up. I mentioned to you that I love that you do these Instagram stories. Well, you were doing the Instagram stories. I guess it was, I don't even know what day it is anymore. I guess it was maybe last year or the year before. You were doing like a whole series on like cappuccino or in coffee and Pat Benatar. Oh, yeah. So we can get into that later. But I really enjoy your stuff. I mean, I enjoy
Thank
what you,
you
do. I enjoy, you know, watching your social media accounts, and I get hungry, and I guess that is the most important thing, is because, you know, we have to eat. You know, eating is the most important. Well, I shouldn't say it's the most important, but it's one of the most important things in our life is to eat. And Michelle, we're gonna be bouncing back. I'm Italian. We're gonna be like all over the place tonight.
A lot of hand
movements are gonna be. But Michelle recently released. Now, Michelle, I'm not. I don't want to. I want to be completely honest. I don't want to. I'm going to flatter you. I think.
Okay.
This book. Now, people, first of all, go out and buy this book. It's called Superfied. It's by Michelle DiPietro, and it is the most. I don't know if you can see behind me. I have a lot of books behind me on my shelves over there. I have lots of cookbooks. I probably have, I don't know, close to 1,000 cookbooks. I've never seen one cookbook. That did what you did in this cookbook. And hats off.
Thank you. It is hard. It is hard to find something that hasn't been done before in terms of a cookbook. That's for sure.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of these, you know, I don't know what you even call them, like social media, like trends and stuff like that. But nothing is really something. It's just out there floating. Nothing is ever really put down onto paper. And what you did with your Superfied book. So it's Superfied, soups inspired by your favorite dishes. This yes. is the most original. It definitely is one of the most original cookbooks I've ever had the pleasure of reading. I look through this book. I'm like, it shouldn't work, but it works. It works perfectly.
So there are definitely some recipes in there that seem a little out there.
So I guess number one question, tell us about Superfied.
Superfied is my first cookbook that I self-published, and it was, you know, they say every cookbook has a story. I read that somewhere once, and I actually talk about this in my introduction, but the story behind Superfied is that it came out of the stay-at-home period during quarantine when I was spending a lot of time in my one-bedroom apartment in New York City without any outdoor space, and I just needed something else to focus on. And I had this idea to make a, to have a collection of recipes that were soup versions of non-soup dishes. And I had soupified before. I wasn't calling it soupified. I was calling it unlikely soups. And I actually went back and looked. And the first time I posted a recipe on Manja with Michelle, which was an unlikely soup, was like 3 years ago. And it was actually a soup version of the Sardinian pasta dish called Maleretis alla Campidanese. I don't know if you know that dish, but it's like a small pasta in a spicy saffron tomato sauce with sausage.
I love that dish.
Isn't
love
it? Well, I love anything with saffron. So, and that, it's just, it's such a nice dish that one day I was like, I'm going to make a soup like version of this. And I think I used orecchiette just because that was the small pasta that I had, but it was basically all the flavors of that soup. And then like a year later, I made another unlikely soup, which was like a soup version of a very traditional Philadelphia sandwich. I grew up in South Jersey. Sausage, broccoli, rabe, and provolone soup. And then earlier in COVID, I also made like an eggplant tahini. Actually, I should say right before COVID, earlier in the year, I made an eggplant tahini soup. And that was really the impetus for the book because it was more recent. I made this soup and I'm like, this tastes tastes like baba ganoush. And then a friend and I were talking about like putting together, we were, you know, respectively thinking that we would put together ebooks, e-cookbooks as a project, you know, during COVID. Cause I mean, my consulting, which we'll talk about later, wasn't like that busy. I wasn't that busy with consulting. I didn't really have anything going on work-wise. And I started thinking of it very small, meaning I was like, okay, I'll put an ebook together. And in my mind, for whatever reason, I thought that an ebook was like a PDF of a small collection of recipes that I would sell on my website whenever I finally got my website up and running. And it would be good to have a product and something besides the recipes that I post that are not really all connected, you know, on my social media. And then one thing led to another. And I don't know if you know this about me, but I can't do anything small. You know, just like my renovation years ago when I renovated my New York City apartment, it just kept growing, getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, at first it was going to be 10 recipes and then 12. And then I'm like, oh, I'll do 30 recipes. And then it became 31 because I thought one for every month, every day of the month. And someone had said like, oh, you know, you could do print on demand. And I'm like, oh, well, that sounds great. But until I was actually done with the rest, like until I was close to done with the recipes, I didn't really even dig into the details of what it would take to do all the rest of it. You know, for me, I'm a chef. I've been developing recipes for a really long time. It's always all about the food. In fact, that's the name of my consulting company. It's all about the food because I'm so focused on the food and recipes and not so focused on the food styling or all the front of the house stuff that would go along with food. But one thing led to another and all of a sudden I realized I was self-publishing a cookbook. And let me tell you, this realization only came up sometime in September. The book came out right after Thanksgiving. And I was talking to my designer who was working on my website. And we reconnected because we had actually been out of touch for months because I was dragging my feet on getting my website up and running. So we talked for the first time in a while. I'm like, hey, you know, I'm working on this cookbook, just catching up. She's like, oh, well, who's designing your cookbook? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I guess I am. I'm like, I didn't even know that that was something that needed to be done. This is how like really ignorant I was about the whole process. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know if I thought I would just type this up on Word and it would be okay. Or again, I really hadn't thought it through, but it was when I finally had that conversation sometime in August with my designer. Anyway, I ended up hiring her to do the design of the cookbook. That's when it started to become much more of like a project management and less about the actual recipes. I mean, there was a lot involved and we can go into that if you want, but.
I guess that would be my next question is how, I mean, obviously you said, you know, again, we're talking to Michelle DiPietro. She is a culinary consultant. She is a blogger, a food blogger. She is a cookbook author. And she recently released Soupified. It is soups inspired by your favorite dishes. And it's, again, so you said that you wanted to do 31 or you did 31 recipes in a book.
Yes.
So did you test every recipe? Like how did that, what was the process? And first of all, coming up with the recipe, because like I said, one of the ones that really caught me when I went through the book was this bacon cheeseburger soup. That sounds freaking amazing.
And that's actually what's on the cover. That's the bacon cheeseburger soup.
So kind of talk to us a little bit about, you know, your inspiration for, you know, like how did you come up with these recipes? Why did you choose certain recipes? Kind of give us a little bit of like, what was your mind? What was the process going on in your mind as you were, I guess, well, first of all, wanting to create it as an ebook, but then it just took on kind of a life of its own.
So I started with just a brain dump of ideas of things that I thought would be good in soup form. And I just first documented them on the notes section of my phone, which is where I keep a lot of my ideas and brainstorming sessions. And then, you know, thinking about a collection, you want to have a cross section of vegetarian and then the different types of proteins. So seafood, chicken, beef, pork, etc. And then I thought it would also be good to have a couple of cold soups. So, you know, I wanted to cover the different categories and then started kind of narrowing down the ideas from there. Once I started making a couple of the recipes, I started to get a better idea of which types of soups would work, which types of dishes would work well soupified, because not everything can be soupified, right? You can't really soupify. I mean, maybe you could, but like, for example, cacio e pepe, I thought about, oh, can I do a cacio e pepe soup? But there's not much to cacio e pepe besides pecorino and black pepper and pasta. So, and there's the definition right there. yes, it's a new word, soupify. So, you know, in terms of how did I come up with the actual ones that I selected? I don't know. I think I just have like a crazy mind because I'm constantly like thinking of different and new ideas for recipes. Before I went into the kitchen, like in terms of the process of how you develop, I developed the soups. Before I actually went into the kitchen, I planned out every detail of the recipes, like ad nauseum, like really thought through everything, like when I would add the ingredients, how much of the ingredients, because I wanted the recipes to be successful the first time I made them. Mm-hmm. And that's also how I work in general. I've been a recipe developer for years on the commercial side, and that, you know, it's sort of the same process for me. And I have to say all the recipes worked out really, really well the first time. One of them I had to redo right after immediately. And that was not because the recipe wasn't like planned out well. It was because I left the room and I ended up boiling a soup with milk and the milk just broke and it was just a disaster. So, and that was the loaded baked potato soup, you know, but other than that, that's sort of my process of like coming up with recipes. And to answer your question, yes, every recipe was tested in the book by someone that was not me, you know, so I had a select group of family and friends that are home cooks that I knew would actually follow the recipes that I sent them verbatim and also give me really good feedback. You know, I put a feedback form together and I had all these different parameters and asked them about it. And it was actually a really great eye-opening process for so many reasons, whether it was just like the technical terms that I was using in the recipe, like the word render or the word deglaze, that I take for granted a lot of terms because I'm a professional chef. And sometimes I forget that like not everyone knows what this is, but that exercise taught me that I probably shouldn't use those words. Or if I do, I should explain them a lot better. And then I did make adjustments to the recipes for sure, mm-hmm. based on the feedback that I got. And it was really a great process. So I'm really, really glad I went that extra step, because at some point when I had this realization that, oh my God, I'm self-publishing a cookbook, you know, I was like in for a penny, in for a pound. Like at this point, I've spent so much time developing these recipes. I love these recipes. I'm so excited about putting them in a collection. And that's the part that's original. I mean, if you Google bacon cheeseburger soup or cheeseburger soup, you will find definitely lots of recipes out there for cheeseburger soup. I'm not saying like I've come up with something that no one else has come up with. And I actually talk about that in my introduction. Like we all come up with a lot of the same ideas, and what's different and unique about them is what we of ourselves like put of ourselves into those recipes and how we like choose to present them and what's our own twist on them. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, yeah, sure, I had my own twist, my own way of writing a recipe, but it was my choice to put all these recipes together into a collection of soupified recipes. And that I think is what is unique.
But again, I mean, you know, I could have a recipe for, you know, making, you know, macaroni and meatballs. That's, you know, that's my family recipe. But again, to what you did was that you created something that you said that there were maybe recipes on the internet, but nothing was ever, like you said, cataloged, that was put in print that you can say, okay, I'm on the shelf. And I have to be honest with you, if you can notice from my bookshelves, I do not believe in reading on a phone or on a Kindle or on,
right.
I want the real thing.
Me too.
I want it in the kitchen. If it gets dirty, if it gets, a little stain here and there, it kind of shows that you're using it.
For sure.
So it's not just, sitting on the shelf for show. And the other thing, maybe I'm weird, is that the smell of paper, the smell of a book, it's one of the best. I mean, besides food, it's one of the best smells in the world.
It is. I
don't know why. Maybe I'm just an old school person. I'm an old soul, as they say. But I prefer the old. Again, I know I'm doing a podcast on Facebook and social media, so I'm not that old school. But again, I appreciate, the hard work of our ancestors. Now we're going to get to a whole other topic here. The hard work of our ancestors, to go the old school way. To go, again, you went the extra mile, and not many people do that. They could write up a quick recipe, put it online, boom, and then forget about it. You actually took – now, how long did it take you to develop this book?
I started working on it. I think the first recipe that I – was like the end of April, and the last recipe was
– of 2020.
Yeah.
Oh, so it was a pretty quick
– It was. Like I said, it was an idea that came up during stay-at-home COVID. And I think the last recipe that I developed was – at the end of August. Now, I wasn't working that quickly. I could have probably done it quicker if I really was thinking about it more strategically in the beginning. And I could have probably finished in a couple of months, but I kind of stretched it out, I did all the rest, most of the recipes in my apartment. I also photographed them all. And that was the other thing about like me thinking of this as like an ebook in the beginning, because again, in my ridiculous view of an ebook, for whatever reason, when I thought like, oh, this is just a PDF, I'm just going to go ahead and do the pictures myself, because if I have to wait until I can afford a food photographer, I'll never do it. And I thought that was okay for an ebook. But if I had told myself back in April that I was self-publishing a cookbook, I would have been like, oh, well, I have to hire a professional photographer. I don't know how to do that. It's probably going to cost a lot of money. No. And I would have talked myself out of it so quickly, but because it kind of just happened a little bit over time, I don't know. I guess it worked out, I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. It makes sense. So I want to know again, I'm Anthony Sheila, better known as Tony Monger. You're listening to At the Table with Tony. You're watching it on Facebook and YouTube. And we are joined today by a cookbook author, by social media extraordinaire, Michelle DiPietro. And I want to thank her again for taking some time out to talk with us tonight. But we are talking about her brand new cookbook, hot off the presses. It's entitled Soupified. Soups inspired by your favorite dishes. So I guess the other key question I want to ask about the book is, how do I get it? Where do people get Soupified?
You can get the Kindle ebook version and the paperback on Amazon.com. And those two are only available on Amazon.com because I set them up, basically published them through KDP.
Which is
Kindle Direct Publishing, which is the arm of Amazon that does this. So, okay. Self-publishing. I actually also have a hardback version of the book, which I did on a platform called Ingram Spark. It's also available on Amazon, but it's just not like set up through them because you can't do hardcovers through them. But it's also available on Barnes & Noble. In fact, if you just Google Soupify, you'll find the hardcover on many, many websites of digital like booksellers.
What was the process though? So again, You knew you wanted to write a cookbook. So what was the back end or the back behind the scenes of getting it onto these platforms? Was it, you contact them?
Do you really want to know about this?
Maybe somebody out there, the last however many months, almost a year that I've been sitting in quarantine, I wrote a book. Now, how can I get it out there to the masses? Kind of maybe just give us a quick little,
quick overview is that after you have all of your content, and that means edited content. So however you want to edit it. I mean, I had, I spent a lot of time with one of my closest friends in the world who helped me, who's a great editor, who helped me edit it. But I also hired a professional editor who also did the index and whatnot. So once you have like the interior of the book, so essentially all of your content inside, and that's easier said than done. So that takes a while. But once you have that, you want to turn that over to a designer, unless you know how to do the design yourself. And that person will, like, you know, will lay it out. And the design process takes time because there's a back and forth, kind of like a much, much bigger version of if you wanted to get a logo, let's say, for your business, only mm-hmm. it's many, many more pages, you know. Yeah. So then you have the design, and then you have to design the cover, and the cover is also like another skill, because you have to figure out how big the spine needs to be. That, and there are calculations out there that, like, that allow you to do that. But once you have, let's say, the PDF of the book, the actual uploading it and stuff to, say, a platform like KDP is actually very streamlined. However, I don't really think it's as easy to figure out as everybody says it is. And what I mean is, I had a lot of questions, and practically everyone who got back to me said, oh, everything is just in the help center of the Amazon website. And you know what? Like, it probably is, but there are pages and pages and pages and pages. And if you've never, you really don't know where you're starting, you really need someone to help you through that. So I actually hired a person to help me through, navigate and help me with the whole uploading and everything relating to Amazon and Ingram Spark. And that involves as well, just like kind of setting up your book in certain categories on Amazon so that they can reach a certain ranking. That involves like putting together all of the introduction, the book description, all the words and stuff that are on the Amazon pages. All that takes time to do. So I actually hired someone to help me with that. I'm of course generating all the content, but mm-hmm. this person's kind of holding my hand through the process. And to be honest, once you have like the inside content done, it's a big project management. You know, it's kind of making sure that everything happens the way that it should happen. And it really wouldn't have been maybe as stressful as it was if I wasn't trying to hit a certain launch date. But mm-hmm. again, once I kind of realized that, all right, I'm in this, and I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to do everything as best as I can, and I'm going to make it look a really good cookbook. I wanted to get it out for soup season of 2020, 2021. I didn't want to kind of like move slowly like I have been on my website because yeah. I didn't want to like miss the boat. Like it's a great book. I love this book. It's, you know, launching the book in like during right at the beginning of holiday season mm-hmm. and during the winter soup, big soup making months. And also it's a comfort food book. And to launch that at a time when everyone is home still because of COVID and what's going on in the world. Like there were so many reasons to just keep pushing to really try and get it out. So it did get launched. There was a lot of praying, but it did get launched like right after November, right after Thanksgiving at the end of November.
Now I'm going to ask you probably it might be the toughest question I'm going to ask you tonight. Is this is like choosing your favorite child. What is your favorite? I'm sure you've had this question. What's your favorite recipe in the book?
It is like choosing your favorite child, and I feel like they are all my children, and I like so many of them.
Okay, so maybe.
However, I'd have to say if I had to pick one, it might be the chicken marsala soup.
Okay, why?
Because I love Marsala anything, and mm-hmm. Marsala adds like such a nice, unique, distinct flavor to any dish in which you use it. And I feel like that is such a great, like that chicken Marsala soup, chicken Marsala soupified tastes so much like chicken Marsala. It really is almost like the exact same dish. And it's just really good. It's a broth. It's a thickened brothy soup. It's not completely brothy like a chicken pastina, but it's not like a thick soup like the bacon cheeseburger soup. Mm-hmm. And I inherently usually prefer brothy soups. So I think that's another reason why I like that soup. And I'd probably say in conjunction with that, one of my other favorites, believe it or not, and I feel like it's kind of cliche, is the orecchiette with broccoli rabe and sausage soup. Again, it's a brothy soup and it has flavors in it that just complement each other so well.
So now I guess the next question is how do you soupify? So how do you say, okay, how much liquid am I going to add to make it a true soup and not, you know, and not a sauce per se? So
that's a really good question. And I do think that you need to have fundamental like skills in knowing how to make soup in order to develop a recipe that's a soupified version. But the first step I would say is before you decide to even go into the kitchen is get to know intimately, if you don't already, the dish that you're basing the soup on, because it's not really going to work out if you try and soupify something that you've never had. You know, all the underlying dishes on which the soups are based, I know really, really well. So I know how they're supposed to taste. I've made them many, many times. I know what all the components are. So that I would say that's number one, is really understand the underlying dish on what the soup is based on. And then decide, based on the characteristics of the underlying dish, well, what kind of soup is it going to be? Is it going to be a brothy soup? Is it going to be more like a thick soup? Is it going to be chunky? Is it going to be pureed? If it's going to be thick, how are we going to thicken it? Are we going to thicken it with a roux, which mm-hmm. is classic kind of fat and flour combination, like butter and flour, oil and flour? Or are we going to thicken it by pureeing something thick, like potatoes or beans or bread? You know, and I think I've done that in all. I think all I've done that in all the soups in the book. Like, there's one thickened with beans. There's one thickened with potatoes. There's lots thickened with roux. I also thickened one with bread. And then the other important thing is thinking about the flavors and the textures in the underlying dish. And often something gets kind of lost in translation when you're soupifying it, which means that you've lost like a texture or you've lost like an element. For example, the eggplant parm soup is a great example. The eggplant parm, the flavors are pretty easy to replicate in a soup setting. So, you know, mm-hmm. I roasted the eggplant, I had all this eggplant pulp, which essentially got simmered in a liquid along with other flavors and ingredients. And then I pureed it. Mm-hmm. And then I added some cheese at the end. But then what do you do with that breadcrumb? Like for me, and I know not everyone makes their eggplant parm the same way, but I was making the eggplant parm soup based on the eggplant parm that I grew up on that my mom was used to make. And she breaded her eggplant. So they, you know, it always had the breading, the fried breading. So it was crispy. So the eggplant parm soup in my book is topped off with a fried cheesy breadcrumb. Mm. So, you know, breadcrumbs in a pan that are fried very quickly in a pan with oil and pecorino. And I think that has pecorino and Parmigiano Reggiano. And then, you know, you kind of like sprinkled it copiously on the soup. So when you like get a spoonful of that soup and you get the breadcrumbs and you get the pureed, you really do think you're eating eggplant parm. And there's many, many soups in the recipes in the book that have toppings in them included in the recipes. And when there's a topping included, you really need to make it in order to get the full effect. Like the Chinese egg roll soup, for example, has fried crispy wontons. The Reuben soup has buttery rye croutons. The Philly cheesesteak soup actually has the bread component as well. And I made like a crouton with the sub roll. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, the toppings when they're needed. And in fact, going back to the chicken Marcella soup, I didn't need it for that because there wasn't any defining texture that was missing in the soup form. It mm-hmm. was like it pretty much covered it. But so if there is a topping in the recipe, make the topping because it makes a big difference, you know, in the final recipe.
But also, I guess what we probably, we're talking to Michelle DiPietro. She is a cookbook author. She is a social media personality doing some amazing stuff with food online. But I guess one thing that I should have mentioned is that really a soup, if you think about it, is something that is eaten with a spoon. So again, you know, these dishes, these dishes that traditionally, you know, you would eat with a knife and a fork per se. Now you're using only the spoon component, the spoon utensil. So I probably should have mentioned that earlier in the podcast that, you know, that really, you know, talking about soup, it's something that you're not going to be, you can't cut a soup, you know, so it's really something that needs to be eaten with a spoon.
Yes. Yeah. And then just one last thing I thought about in developing the recipe. Sometimes, you know, I did need to add ingredients or I chose to add ingredients that weren't necessarily like typical of the original underlying dish, but that just worked better or made the whole soup format work better. Mm-hmm. For example, I think in the Reuben soup, I actually have potatoes in the broth, a little bit of potatoes in the broth to just add, because a Reuben is just like a really hearty, thick soup, mm-hmm. like dish. It's not something that's light. So, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't want the broth to be kind of like a light broth. I wanted it to be, have a lot of substance. So there are like tiny potatoes in that just to kind of add substance and texture to the broth. This, and then the same thing with the crab cake soup, I actually added red pepper and I forget what the other item was, just because it seemed like it needed a little bit more than what was in like an original lump crab cake, for example. Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, these are putting your you know, again, the dishes are traditional dishes, but you're yes. putting you're soupifying them to your yes. to your taste or to what's going to work yes. when somebody makes them at home.
Right.
So again, you have to get this book. You have to go out there. So Amazon.com is probably, you said, the best place to get it.
Yes.
And just Google, let's spell Superfied. It's S-O-U-P-I-F-I-E-D. Superfied. Yes. That's Superfied. So go out and buy Michelle's book. But you know, Michelle, there's so much more I want to also talk to you a little about. Again, you know, I kind of focus more on the Italian American aspects of everything. Right. And we talked a little bit before we went on live. That you know where your family is from in Italy. So kind of give us a little bit of background on who Michelle DiPietro is. You know, where are your people, your ancestors from? Where are you from? You know, I know you said that you live in New York City now, but you didn't always live in New York. So kind of give us a little bit of who Michelle is.
Sure. So I am 100% Italian American. My grandparents, all four of them, were immigrants during the first diaspora at the early 1900s. And my dad's parents, the DiPietros, came separately from Abruzzo in the Teramo province of Abruzzo. And my mom's parents, again, separately came over from Sicily, the Provincia di Palermo. So I'm half Abruzzese, half Sicilian. So my parents, they were, you know, a mixed marriage as far as I think, you know, some of my grandparents were concerned. And I grew up in South Jersey in Cherry Hill. I actually grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. It was not an Italian enclave, although my parents grew up in Italian enclaves. And I always loved to cook. You know, I mean, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. She cooked all the time. I cooked a lot and made pasta with my grandmother when I was younger. And I think because I always loved to eat, I just always loved being in the kitchen. I was that five-year-old who was cooking with my mom, learning how to make eggs first and just helping in the kitchen. I made Sunday gravy and homemade pasta, homemade gnocchi, and also with my grandmother and my aunts, I also learned a lot from as well. But I never considered going into food as a career because I was also really into academics. And only when I was in a career that I wasn't really passionate about did I make the leap and actually change. I was an accounting major in college. I went to work for one of the world's top public accounting firms out of college. I became a CPA when I was 24 and I was in audit. I was an auditor for 5 years, financial auditor for 5 years, all financial services clients in New York City. And I also worked in Geneva, Switzerland for 2 years in my mid-20s, which really was with the same company. And I mentioned that because like that, those 2 years in Europe at such a young age were such a life-defining experience for me. Prior to going to Europe, I was really thinking like, I might want to go into the food business. Mm. Not something I really talk to anyone about that much because, you know, I had tons of student loans and like, I was only out of college a couple of years. It's, you just don't want to have that conversation with your parents. Like, oh, you know what? I'm thinking about leaving public accounting and going to cooking school. So, you know, I kind of just put that off. I saw the opportunity to live in Europe and I did that, but that like, you know, being exposed to so much food and so many different cultures and I traveled so much and I just really just like, absorbed, I mean, so many different things. I learned how to work with a lot of different ingredients. That kind of gave me the courage to come back to the States, quit my job. I moved back in with my parents when I was 27 and I went to cooking school in Philadelphia.
Wow.
And I never went back, you know, and I knew that restaurants weren't my calling. I didn't have any desire to like work the line. I figured I would have to do it for a little while. But what I really wanted to do was be in the industry and combine my business background with food somehow. And I just figured going to cooking school was the best way to get into the business. I thought that maybe one day I would open my own gourmet food store, like an Italian specialty store, because I loved the idea of prepared foods when I had lived in New York, when I was working for the public accounting firm. And this is before prepared foods was everywhere. So I didn't end up doing that, but I did end up working for a supermarket and a small company called Whole Foods Market. You may have heard of them. Yeah. And I worked for them for like a really long time. I started out in operations in the stores, was there in the stores for a couple of years. And then moved into corporate. And for most of the rest of my career, I had my dream job. You know, I was basically developing culinary concepts and menus and recipes and region-wide culinary initiatives. It was at a time when the company was putting a lot of the mini restaurants, we called them venues, and eateries within the store. So worked on those concepts, soup to nuts, you know, from concept through opening day and more. So, and did that over and over and over again. So we're, you know, everything from concept development to menu, recipe, costing, training materials, you know, so it was great experience. And then after that, I, at some point I, you know, I moved on to a small, at the time we called it like a startup slash turnaround. It was actually a 100% organic, plant-based juice and food company based in New York City. Ended up being a kind of a short-lived experience because it was a company that got sold. It was a little volatile. It got sold like less than a year and a half into it of me being there. And then like I got laid off along with everybody else in leadership. So we all saw the writing on the wall. I knew it was coming. And I started to think, well, maybe I should just go out on my own. You know, it's been a lot of years of working for a company. So I did. And in 2015, so now I can't believe it's been over 5 years ago, I started It's All About the Food LLC, which is my culinary consulting company. And I am an independent consultant. I work with, I would say, an eclectic lineup of food businesses, and the services that I offer have evolved over time. And for the most part, lately, I'm working on the creative side of the menu. So whether it's like concept development, food trends analyses, recipe development, menu engineering, re-engineering, that kind of thing.
So what exactly is culinary consulting? Explain what that means.
A company may hire me to work on, let's say, to redo their menu, you know, and that means coming up with not only like ideating a new menu, but commercializing it. So developing recipes, but then developing them for production. Whether it's if it's a restaurant, it would be developing recipes that would actually be produced. So they're different from recipes that you're writing for the home cook. Very different, you know. And more often than not, it's actually developing recipes that will be produced at, say, a large commissary. Ultimately, could be 100-pound batches or bigger. The financials that relate to that. You know, a lot of times I'll cost the recipes or cost out the whole menu, that kind of thing.
I mean, really. I mean, you think about it. I mean. But again, being in a restaurant business, whether it's, you know, the front of the house, whether it's consulting, is a lot different than, I'm sure, kind of, you know, writing a cookbook, right? I mean,
it's a completely different thing.
Obviously, you know, food is the center of it all, but again, it's two totally different. It's
totally sides of the
animals.
Food.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and I've always wanted to write a cookbook. I mean, you know, I think anyone who's probably been to cooking school or who's worked in the industry, mm-hmm. always sort of has that in the back of their head. Like, one day I'll write a cookbook. But I guess I never really wanted to do it bad enough, because it wasn't like all those years that I was working a lot for a company. I wasn't like coming home after work and working on a cookbook. So, I mean, it was sort of like out there, like, one day I'll get to it. I never thought I would do it in the middle of a pandemic, but I did. So how did I get from food service to what I'm doing now, which is, it's a kind of a odd transition for a lot of people. You don't see a lot of food bloggers that actually, you know, went to cooking school and worked in the industry. But as an independent consultant, and I'm sure like many people out there who are listening can understand this, you have peaks and valleys. So you have times when you're working a lot and you have times when you are not working at all. And it was during one of those down times when I just didn't have any clients that I started working on Manja with Michelle. In fact, I had always had an account, It's All About the Food social media account, but I always had a second account, which was actually called In Abruzzi Si Mangia Bene, which is an expression that I had learned when I traveled to Abruzzo in 2015. It's an expression that means in Abruzzo, you eat well. I just thought it was a fun phrase. So I started a second Instagram account under that name. And it was really just all about my passion and obsession with everything Italian, whether it was what I ate at a restaurant or a fun quote or some, you know, stuff about my travels or food that I was cooking, but I wasn't like posting recipes. I wasn't strategic about it. But I also knew that nobody probably knew what that meant or could even pronounce it, like in Abruzzi Si Mangia Bene. So I came up with the idea to become a little bit more strategic about my second Instagram account, change the name to Manja with Michelle. And then I thought, well, maybe I could like one day work with brands. And, you know, I'd love to feature like different products from different brands. And maybe this could be a great, like, what's the word I'm searching for? Like an add-on, like a complement to my consulting practice, essentially. And that was in November 2017 is when I launched Manja with Michelle. But what I was not expecting was it just took on a life of its own, and it didn't even take all that long. And I was just so overwhelmed by all the connections that I was making with people. And people, I mean, I would say like my whole like network of other people that were doing what I was doing. I just met so many cool people that way. And then so many more people in the Italian American community. Like, it was also right around the time I went to my first NIAF convention, the National Italian American Foundation convention. It just all kind of happened at the same time, and mm-hmm. met people there. And then I just continued to meet more and more people on social media, and then eventually in person. But the most important connections were the ones that I was making with the people out there that were like making my recipes at home and sending me like these beautiful messages, like, oh my God, what you just wrote made so much sense to me, and it just brought me right back to my childhood. Or, you know, this recipe reminded them of like their Nona's, whatever they had made, you know. And I mean, I'm such a like sensitive, like emotional person. So all that was just like, I really like warmed my heart, like at its core, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of kept, I spent more and more time on Manja with Michelle, and just realized like, wow, I think, you know, somewhere along the line, my professional passion started to shift a little bit. And while I'm still consulting and I still love that, I also would love to just sort of transition over the next several years and just, you know, be a full-time Manja with Michelle, you know, and make that what I do and continue to publish cookbooks and continue to put out great content and to eventually launch my website, which will be launched in the next month.
So what is Manja with Michelle? Kind of tell us a little bit about, sure. you know, about what you're doing on the website, what you're doing on your social media accounts. Right. You know, what are people going to find when they follow you on Instagram or on Facebook?
Right. So right now, I say I only have a presence on Instagram and Facebook and under the name Manja with Michelle. And my content is primarily, like, more than 90%, I would say, recipes that I've developed and photographed myself. Original recipes that are rustic. I like to say the brand is innovation, inspiration, and nostalgia in La Cucina, in the Italian kitchen. And while I do often post like the classic Italian, American class, for example, like a pasta fagioli or maybe an Italian wedding soup or maybe the original way of doing carbonara. So I definitely dabble in like the original unadulterated versions of recipes, but more than not, I will put my own twist on something. So it's either like taking Italian ingredients and making them into something completely new, for example, like a puttanesca breadcrumb that might be sprinkled over asparagus, or it's taking something that is a classic recipe and then just doing something completely not classic with it, like, for example, an avocado carbonara. And Superfied really is...
So kind of explain that. Back up a second. avocado carbonara?
Yeah, that's a recipe I first developed.
Talk to us about this.
I first developed that recipe for a client, for a consulting client. And I'm actually going to develop a home-based recipe of that for an upcoming event in early March. So, you know,
okay. Everyone out there... So stay tuned.
But, yes, I would say stay tuned, you know, but... It's.
Well, I guess it makes sense because the avocado has a lot of fat.
Right.
So, okay, and I guess a classic carbonara would just be egg yolks, right? They don't put the whole egg in it.
I don't use egg yolks, although a lot of people use the whole egg. But yeah, egg yolks, pancetta, pecorino, black pepper, pasta
but,
water.
You know, but really what's amazing about, you know, a lot of, I guess, these rustic dishes, even whether it's Italian, whether it's German, whether it's Polish, a lot of these are just, you know, simple ingredients that, really, you know, these people found on their farm, or they found at the local, you know, the market that they actually walked to. I mean, that I think is what's so special. And in a way, I think that we lost that for many years. But I see us kind of coming back to that, even with these special boutique websites, you know, where you can buy, for example, I'm a coffee freak. And I happened to find this website looking on Instagram or social media, or Facebook or Instagram. And I don't know, I'm going to say it wrong. It's like Nguyen. It's a Vietnamese coffee company based out of Brooklyn. And they actually sell the coffee that's from Vietnam with the actual special Vietnamese coffee filter. So I had to buy it.
Oh, how was it?
I don't know. I didn't get it yet. I just saw it over the weekend. So I ordered it. So hopefully it's coming soon. I can have it this weekend. But again, that's what I like, you know, is kind of, you know, these things that, you know, again, I think that's what the internet is good for, is that we can now, we're a global world where we could, you know, kind of borrow and take from other kind of cultures and cuisines. And that to me, you know, if we didn't have the internet, if we don't have technology, we wouldn't have that. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe you could speak a little bit to that, you know, kind of, you know, borrowing from other cultures and kind of making it our own in a way, which I think that's what America is, right? We always say it's a great melting pot.
Yeah, and I think it's just about enjoying and having fun with cooking. You know, I used to be one of the people that was a rule follower. Like that's, you know, I went to cooking school. I learned the classic cooking techniques. And I, you know, for the longest time, all I did was follow exactly what I did learned in cooking school. But I've softened over time, obviously. And I think that it's important that no matter what you do, that you cook. And it's if what makes you cook is that you want to have fun with your food and you want to have fun with flavors and you want to try something new and you want to put two things together that wouldn't normally go together, then you should just do it. And I mean, the thing is, we have access to that. We have lots of people that, first of all, are doing it. So there's a lot of inspiration out there and to give you ideas. And you also have access to all these ingredients that we normally, you know, or I should say, you know, we didn't always have access to. So why not? You know, I mean, Superfied is essentially a great example of doing stuff that's outside the box. You know, I mean, it's a great example of looking at soups in a different way. Mm-hmm. I've even taken, what is it called? There's this Japanese spicy paste, like a really great spicy paste. I've infused that into cream and made like a spicy Japanese gnocchi with that. Like,
really?
It's kind of out there, but like, why not? I mean, it's a paste, kind of like a tomato paste or an anchovy paste. It's just a spicy, like Japanese paste, and it has its own flavor.
Not like gochujang, not like that.
Gochujang is a Korean. Okay, I mean, that's Korean. That's actually another great example of that's like a hot pepper paste. But no, of course, I can't think of the name off the top of my head. I mean, I can picture exactly what it looks like. But I think that that's just where we are, you know, and the technical term in the industry is culinary mashup. Culinary mashup is when you take like, you know, items or flavors from different ethnic cuisines and you put them together.
I mean, believe me, I am a traditionalist, but I like to experiment as well. Like, for example, over the weekend, I made a pepperoni sauce. So there's a guy, he's originally from Jersey. He was down. I don't even know where he is now. His name is Mike Isabella. But he made this pepperoni sauce. So I said, the heck with it. I said, I haven't had it in years. I want to make it. So I made that. And then there's a local pasta shop. This guy makes some of there's actually two. It's called Mike's. I'm going to give him a plug because they're the best.
Yeah.
Mike's Pasta and Sandwich Shop in Nutley, New Jersey. And they make all their own fresh pasta. And he made a black garlic bucatini. So I said, Mike, I said, I'm going to make this pepperoni sauce. I said, you know, which pasta and you know that you made, which one should I try? He goes, go with the black garlic. So that's another great thing. You know, you kind of get opinions from other people. You know, you become friendly with chefs, and you kind of kind of get their opinion. You know, kind of get their feeling on dishes and stuff. Yeah. But I think that is important as well. It's kind of, you know, supporting these local shops. So my next question I want to ask you is that, you know, during this pandemic, I know, you know, a lot of places, a lot of restaurants, a lot of people have been suffering, you know, just because things were shut down and the lockdowns and the shutdowns and the curfews and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, what are some of your favorite go-to places right now, I guess, in New York City?
I haven't really been going to that many places in New York, but I do fortunately, I mean, lately, I do fortunately live right near Mama's too. I don't know if you know that pizza place on the Upper West Side.
I've heard a lot about it. I've heard a lot about it.
Yeah. So that's a place and they deliver and I've, you know, popped in there. They have probably the best pizza that I've had in the city. It's different. It's, I don't know what's, it's this, it's the style of Mama's too, but it's a beautiful dough and they like I think there might even be some cheese in the dough and just really high-end ingredients. So that's great. Other places, I've been just trying to support the local places around my neighborhood, like the local diner and the smaller places. Because frankly, like I live up in the Upper West Side in a neighborhood with just a lot of small restaurants, a lot of small no-name restaurants that you wouldn't know, but I just don't want them all to close, frankly.
No, it's, you know, again, I mean, there's a guy, I don't know, I'm sure you've seen his Barstool
charity fund.
And what this guy's doing is, you know, really, he really kind of, you know, he grabbed the bull by the horn, so to speak. And he is helping to support these restaurants that, or not even restaurants. He's doing like, he did like a ballet company. He did like, I couldn't even think. There's just so many that he's been doing. I think they raised over $20 million, which is like that's phenomenal. But really, it is important to try to support the little guy now because you know with without the mom and pop shops. I mean, like I said, you know, there's a local bakery by me. There's Vita Mia Pasta by me. So there's these little places that we have to kind of support as much as we can, especially in these crazy times. But in a way, like I said, it kind of goes back to knowing who your vendors are, knowing who, you know, knowing the greengrocer, knowing the butcher, you know, recommend to me something, you know, Joe the Butcher, what should I have, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, can you speak a little bit to, you know, kind of, I guess, that sense of going back, you know, going forward, but also going back and, you know, kind of, I guess, becoming more personable. I obviously, we're always on these darn phones, but really it is important to have a conversation, even if it's over Zoom or StreamYard or whatever.
Is it more personable with your vendors?
I guess in general, but you know, I guess you want to speak to how.
Yeah, I wish. I think that I think being where I live, I've lost a little bit of that. Like, I don't have my neighborhood butcher shop. I have to be honest. I don't. You know, I think that it's a little bit, and I'm not in a enclave, say per se, where I have a lot of that, but I'm. So I don't know if I'm really going to be able to offer that much in that area, unfortunately. And I have been doing a lot of online shopping and grocery shopping and whatnot. Although I actually go to the local small grocery store a lot and support them. I don't really know anyone, like a lot of them by person. Like unfortunately in my neighborhood, you don't have that same, I think what you're able to experience a lot in the different neighborhoods in New Jersey. And I think when you have a car, it's a little, and you can go out and about, it's a little bit different.
Yeah.
But in terms of being personable, I mean, I'm all about being personable. You know, I'm all about connections and one-on-ones with people. And I don't know if I'm really answering your question.
So talk to it, you know, growing up, so you grew up in South Jersey. So maybe, talk to what was it like growing up in South Jersey? You know, I'm sure there was the neighborhood down there. I'm sure, you know, I know you said it was a predominantly Jewish neighborhood, but I'm sure there were lots of great, I mean, are there still places in South Jersey where you grew up that, you know, that kind of had that feel?
I think so, for sure. And I go to South Jersey a lot. My family's down there. And there's a lot of places that have popped up that have been, I haven't lived down there in a really long time, but a lot of places that are like that have popped up. And I will go out of my way, because again, I think it's a little bit easier in the suburbs. And I do have a car, where even just when I was down in South Jersey over the holidays, driving like way out of the way, even further to this one place to get the Italian sausage, because it's just really good from this one place, that, and it's a small little Italian grocery store, actually not that far from Hamilton. We were talking about Hamilton earlier.
What's the place?
Bagliani's.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's like on the main drag, isn't it?
It's kind of like a main drag. I don't know the name of the street, you know? And I also, there's just like the really great bakery. Well, my cousins actually have a bread bakery in South Jersey. So,
okay. Well, plug away. Come on.
Deluxe Italian Bakery. They have like the soft kind of hoagie rolls and the great rolls for cheesesteak, but they also have tons and tons of pastries. And like they're written up every year for the best donuts in New Jersey. Like the best, their cut cream donuts are like no other, you know. So they do custom cakes.
Now, where are they?
They're actually in Runnymede. They've been around. It was my uncle through marriage. His family started the bakery. So all my cousins still work there. Yeah, they're in Runnymede, just off the Black Horse Pike. And they have, you know, great selection of breads and pastries. But then there's also the little place close to, you know, where I usually stay, which has the great tomato pie, which is very much like a South Jersey, South Philly thing, which is more like a bakery pie without the cheese on it. Although they do have the version with the cheese, but I always get the one without the cheese. And I definitely am all about like driving for good food, even going into Philly, you know, like going into Philly to get the great Middle Eastern food that I like, because I, you know, again, I love meeting people that are passionate about what they're doing. And there's this small place in Philly, in South Philly, and it's called Bitar's, B-I-T-A-R. They have the best grilled chicken sandwich I have had anywhere.
Really?
You know, grilled chicken sandwich is very basic, right? But theirs is just like filled with extra love. And then that's all. It's just like a block or two off 9th Street, which is where all the other Italian shops are and stuff, the great cheese shop. And sometimes I'll get fresh pasta, not that often.
Again, my name is Anthony Shilia, better known as Tony Mangia. We are at the table with Tony. We're joined today by Michelle DiPietro. She is the author of the brand new book, Superfied. You can also check her out at mangiawithmichelle.com. That's MangiaWithMichelle.com. So that's what they should say. It's because I know Michelle could be spelled with the two L's too.
Thank you. Yes.
You're Michelle with one L. So I want to make that point. But so Michelle, tell us some of your favorite places to go out to eat. So whether it's in wherever, it could be anywhere in the world, really. I mean, it's, you know, is there a certain spot that you like in Sicily? Is there a spot that you like?
Oh my goodness. And I've had the fortunate to travel to Italy quite a bit over my lifetime, and nothing compares to Rome. I love Sicily. I've been to Sicily a couple times in the most recent years, but Rome is really everything to me. You know, they have like the pastas, they have the great bakeries, they have the great Roman pizza, which I love. Just sort of, I'd say Mama's too reminds me of like a little bit. They have the great markets. Sicily is really great, I'd say, because of all like the access to great seafood, fresh seafood, different varieties of seafood, and also the food and the pastries are so, like, Sicily is so regionalized. And I love going to Sicily because it really, I loved going to Sicily for the first time, which was after traveling to and being to like various other regions of Italy, realizing how unique Sicily is and how regionalized the food is and how it really is different. And you can see the Arab influences, you know, in their recipes and their cuisines.
I mean, really, even from town to town throughout the boot, the recipes can be so different in the names of the recipes, or the names of the dishes are totally different. But so what are some of your favorite Italian? I know, again, I'm talking about Italian, but what are some of your favorite Italian? First, what are some of your favorite traditional Italian dishes? Then we'll get into some of your favorite Italian American dishes.
Oh, traditional Italian dishes.
So whether it's the Mugnagna, I'm saying it wrong, from the Abruzzo. It's that long.
I actually never had that.
You never had that? Really?
I never had that.
Le Vertu in South Philly makes a great one.
I've been meaning to go there for so long. I actually have a gift card to go there. And I got the gift card right before COVID hit, like last January. And I've been meaning to go there for years. Yes. So look, I'm a big fan of Le Vertu, even though I haven't actually eaten there yet. I'd say as a category, the pork dish, like the pork products and the dishes with the pork products in Italy are so great, because the pork products are just so great in Italy, and they just really know what they're doing. So I do love, not to be cliche, but I do love like the amatriciana and the carbonara and those dishes that are fairly simple with only a few ingredients, but that have like that really, really flavorful pork in it that like just brings the dish to a whole other level. And I love lamb. I love the arrosticini. Well, I know you actually connect it with D'Abruzzo.
Yeah,
I met him. I actually, like, one day, a couple years back, I don't know, maybe it was like 3 years ago, I actually went to Brooklyn and I worked with him one day. He's such a cool guy. I loved the food in Abruzzo, and like the arrosticini and the lamb was like, you can't really compare it to anything else. And I love the pastas of Sicily, like the bucatini alla sarda, the pasta alla norma, and just the sardines and stuff in Sicily. I actually really like Italian American dishes. I feel like the more sauce, the better. I gotta be honest. I'm a sauce girl. I love my eggplant parm. I love a good chicken parm. It doesn't even need to have the cheese on it. But I love all the veggies. You know, I mean,
are you sauce or gravy?
I grew up with gravy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. No. I mean, I know South Philly is a gravy town.
And yes, and I do think that it has something to do with the being the descendants of the people that came over in the early 1900s versus all the descendants of the immigrants that came over with the second group in like the 50s and the 60s that definitely did not use the term gravy.
No.
But where did it originate? I don't know, but it is real. All I know is my grandparents said the word gravy. So I say, now, I mean, I've been in the industry for so long, I pretty much use the word sauce, but I grew up with the word gravy, crab gravy. Actually, that's probably my all-time favorite Italian American. My cousins and I, every summer when I was younger, my Aunt Mary, like we used to get together and have spaghetti and crabs. Is this something that you had? Crabs and spaghetti?
I love spaghetti and crabs.
I do think it's a very hyper regional, like New Jersey Italian, like and the area, you know, the area around it, like Italian American thing.
It's one of my favorite dishes of all time.
There is nothing like the flavor of that sauce after the crabs have been like simmering in it for a while, and all that like sweetness from the crab gets infused into the sauce, and then you know you use that sauce to like toss the pasta and.
Because really, you don't get that much meat out of the crab. I think crab is more to flavor, like you said, it's the flavor of the sauce or flavor of the gravy.
Right.
And actually, I had a great crab gravy at a restaurant, which you don't often see at restaurants. Actually, at Polizzi Social Club in South Philly.
Oh, you went there?
Yeah. Nice. Joey Baldino, he makes an awesome crab gravy. Actually, his restaurant, Zeppoli. And have you been to the one Zeppeli in Collingswood?
No, but I should go. I'm not that far from Collingswood.
But definitely, because actually, we were there a couple of summers ago, and it's beautiful. Like he has a little, it's kind of like, you know, like a neighborhood, like a residential neighborhood, but he has a back patio. It's like you're in Nonno's garden. You know, he has the fig tree, he has the grapes, he has the you know, the little basil and the tomato plants. It's like eating in your grandparents' garden. I mean, it's awesome.
Awesome. Yeah, I do wish I had a garden. Maybe one of these days I'll move back to the suburbs.
Before, I mean, it's amazing that I can't believe we're actually been talking for an hour. It feels like it just went like a blink of an eye. Again, I am Anthony Sciliabera, known as Tony Mangia. I'm being joined tonight by Michelle DiPietro. She is the author of the brand new book, Soupified, Soups Inspired by Your Favorite Dishes. You can get it at Amazon.com. But of course, you can also visit Michelle at her website. It's Mangia with Michelle, M-A-N-G-I-A, W-I-T-H-M-I-C-H-E-L-E, 1-L, Mangia with Michelle with 1L.com. And that's also her name on Instagram. It's also her name on Facebook. So, Michelle, before we conclude, I want you to give us some advice. So somebody, again, you know, we're still going through this period of, this pandemic. So if people want to, you know, kind of, you know, maybe either make it, because I know you said that you made a career change,
yes,
you know, and you're also writing a book. So kind of tell us a little bit, you know, give some advice to somebody out there, you know, who could be watching or listening to the podcast tonight, or, you know, whenever it's on other, whatever, Apple, whatever the heck it is, but kind of give some advice for somebody out there that maybe wanting to write a book or you know, wanting to make a career change. Kind of give us some advice.
Wanting to make a career change is a tough one. I would say, I guess, do your research, and then I feel like it's so much easier these days because it's so much more acceptable to move from one thing to the other. But, you know, if it's something that's completely different, like what I did, if you can, I would say make it like your side hustle first and just dabble in it and see if it's something that you are interested in pursuing. And then I would just say go for it, because, you know, the advice that I got from a friend when I was still working in public accounting and actually was living in Switzerland, I'll never forget. I was having lunch with him, and he's like, you know, Michelle, well, we always seem to regret the things that we don't do, not the things that we do. And I was like, again, it was like advice that I got like right at the moment when I was like, oh my God, should I do this? Does it make sense for me to like leave something like so secure for something that's so not secure? But you only live once. And I mean, do your homework and know what you're getting yourself into. But at the same time, like if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. Like I don't think we hold ourselves to much higher standards than I think other people hold us to. So if you're not sure, just go for it. And then if you're interested in writing a book, I mean, I'm a great example of, I really didn't like set out to write this book, but you definitely, if you want to do it, get started and then finish. Like you're going to probably hit some roadblocks along the way, or maybe kind of get tired of doing it. But if you really want to do it, just kind of push through those and just keep doing it. Reach out to people for help. I definitely did. And try not to set a super aggressive like launch date like I did, because I think that you can make it a lot easier on yourself by giving yourself more time. And that's the self-publishing route. And, you know, for better or worse, I know a lot of people don't like to support Amazon because it's big business, and I totally get that. But Amazon allowed a small business like me to self-publish a book very easily. Mm-hmm. And I am a small business. And so sometimes you just have to look at something in a different way. you know.
So it can be open, I guess, open to
yeah
different avenues or different ways of doing things nowadays.
And yeah, I mean, with something like KDP, Amazon's self-publishing arm, or other companies like that, you can self-publish now. And especially if you're writing a novel or fiction and it's not like a very photo heavy book with a lot of photos, I think you can actually do it really much easier than if it's a cookbook. Cookbook's kind of like a big production. It's a lot, but.
So what's next for Michelle DiPietro?
Well, the website that you gave everyone will be, that's the next big thing. Like that's been, so if you go to the website now, it's just a splash page, but there is a place for you to sign up for my mailing list. And by the way, if you sign up for my mailing list, you will get 3 Supafied recipes that are not in the cookbook, that will not be on the website. So there, if you're kind of wondering like, what are the recipes in the cookbook like, sign up for my mailing list and you'll get spaghetti meatball soup, chicken parm soup, and broccoli rabe sausage and provolone sub soup. So there's that. And then eventually all my, you know, once the website's launched, it'll be the types of recipes that I have, you know, it'll be a lot of classic Italian American dishes and more of what you see on Manja with Michelle Instagram, but all the recipes will then live on my website. And then I definitely plan on writing more books. I have an idea for my next book that I would love to go the traditional publishing route and not the self-publishing route. So it's probably not going to be a single concept book like Supafied, and it'll probably be more of what you would expect to see coming out of Manja with Michelle. And then of course more culinary consulting. So if there is anyone out there who actually needs professional culinary consulting for food service or whatnot, that's, you know, visit my website. It's allaboutthefood.com. You can see a little bit about the other side of my professional life.
Well, Michelle, if somebody out there wants to get in touch with you, tell us the best way, you know, the best way they can get you. Is it Instagram? Is it Facebook? You know, do you know,
Instagram is probably the best and quickest because I feel like messages show up a lot easier on Instagram. Sometimes messages get lost on Facebook for some reason, or you can email me Michelle@manjawithmichelle.com. And again, it's Michelle with one L.
Yes. Yeah. You got to make that. I want to make that point. But Michelle, really, I really do appreciate you taking time out tonight. This was great. I really had a great conversation. Yeah. And I, of course the door is always open for you to come back on in the future.
Thank you for inviting me. This was awesome. I've wanted to be on, you know, at the table with Tony for a while, so I really appreciate you inviting me.
We did like a little like a group thing last
with the Tight Enclaves.
Yeah. But this was nice just to be able to, you know, talk about the book and talk about you and your culinary background. Yeah. So I really enjoyed this time this evening. I do want to mention that on Thursday I will be having a guest. We'll be doing another at the table with Tony. My guest will be Agata DeSantis. She is a filmmaker and an author, and we're going to be talking all about The Malocchio.
Oh.
So if you want to know about The Malocchio, make sure you tune in on Thursday evening live on Facebook and on YouTube. But so that's the plug for Thursday's show. Again, I was joined this evening by Michelle DiPietro. Check her out, Manja with Michelle. Again, that's Manja with Michelle with one L, not with two. So you could, and then again, if you want to go see her on Instagram, it's the same Instagram.com/Manja with Michelle, and same thing with Facebook.com/Manja with Michelle, and also her culinary consulting website is it'sallaboutthefood.com. Yes. I'll put that up on the screen there. But again, Michelle, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out tonight. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you, everybody, for watching.
All right, so we will see you next time at the table with Tony. Again, I am Anthony Scilia, better known as Tony Manja. We'll see you next time. Ciao for now.
At the Table with Tony would like to thank its sponsors, Rocco Muriale, Rob Quick, Joseph Cirillo, Raymond Guarini, Tom Gilmore, Oli G, Peter Ziza, Brian McGuire, Peter Ferreira, Rich Ottenstrauer, Anna Mavrianos, Antonio Pepinella, Anthony Ferraro, Sandra and Bob LaMotta, Mike Guerro, The Italian Enclaves Historical Society,